region, including Iran.
The Bahraini activists argue that without Israeli and American support, the autocratic regimes in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia would collapse in a few days.
Political activists here say Al Khalifa's brutal crackdown on dissent is a proof of their illegitimacy to rule the country. They say the revolution will not subside until the Bahraini royal family relinquish power, on the grounds that it does not represent the majority of Bahrainis. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Liz Truss has gone from political also-ran to holding one of the highest offices of state in the UK, the country's representative to the globe. Promoted by Boris Johnson from International Trade Secretary to Foreign Secretary, with the additional job of solving the Brexit standoff with the EU, as well as pushing through with the talks in Vienna on the revival of the JCPOA, Truss has only been an MP since 2010. Whilst her in-tray may be overflowing, reports reveal the behind-the-scenes briefing Truss has had, this to gauge support as she fights a silent battle with Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. He's seen by many as her main rival for the Prime Minister's position should Johnson quit or be ousted. Truss's shift from staunch Remainer to ardent Brexiteer via a Margaret Thatcher-style makeover has not convinced everyone of her Iron Lady credentials.
I think Liz Truss is regarded by a lot of backbenchers as being quite lightweight. I think there's possibly a bit of sexism in that, but although the Conservative Party has had two women leaders, unlike Labour, I think we've also seen Liz Truss last week in Moscow really banging the war drums, trying to show how tough she was in regards to the whole Ukraine-Russia question. And I think part of that was to please Tory backbenchers.
It's a short walk from the Foreign Office to Downing Street, a fact that would not be lost on Liz Truss and her advisers. It's also a short political step from one of the senior offices of state to the top job. Just ask Boris Johnson, who was Foreign Secretary, before replacing Theresa May as Prime Minister. For a politician with such an important diplomatic brief, scandal has followed Truss with question marks about her judgment. Highlights or lowlifes include racking up thousands on expenses whilst on a three-day trip to Japan, claims of cronyism and using the expensive members-only club owned by a Tory donor during her stint as trade minister.
It doesn't seem to be held against anyone in the Conservative Party. We've seen lots of this around the test and trace thing at the beginning of the pandemic. We've seen a Boris Johnson's flat. We've seen all sorts of stuff around this, and it doesn't seem to ever come back in anyone. So I don't think that's going to bother most Conservative MPs and most Conservative members.
It seems Liz Truss's major selling point is not her intellectual gravitas or political track record. In fact, the opposition points out she did not actually finalise a single new deal that the UK did not have with the EU as trade minister, but rather she's the anti-Sunak, a flip-flopping ideologue who is not an ethnic minority. For some Conservatives, that may just be enough. Amina Taylor, London.
Millions of US dollars have been approved recently by the Israeli regime as part of a plan to connect illegal settlements in occupied East Al-Quds with those built in West the Holy City. This was revealed by Israeli media days after the regime's foreign minister Yair Lapid stated that Israel won't build a new settlement that will impede a future two-state solution, but only settler homes will be built in existing settlements across the occupied territories. Settlement watchdog groups said such statements are meant to deceive the world as settlement activity goes on behind the scenes.
What Lapid is saying is just like playing with the words, but it's so clear and obvious that what's happening in Jerusalem is an ethnic cleansing that's going on and Judaizing the city itself. When they are talking about linking the settlements and the outposts in and around Jerusalem with real way to connect it with West Jerusalem, it's just to make it a surrounding of West Jerusalem and dumping the whole Palestinian communities in East Jerusalem.
Israel's finance committee has approved a plan worth $310 million in order to link settlements in West Al-Quds with the other settlements in East Al-Quds, where the majority of its residents are Palestinians. The plan also includes expansion of the light rail, roads, and infrastructure construction that would be only serving the settlers. Palestinians say this plan will further undermine the feasibility of East Al-Quds as the capital of the future state. Tel Aviv has done everything possible to minimize the Palestinian population in the Holy City and in Area C that constitutes about 60% of the occupied West Bank. Experts say what Israel is doing is annexation of Palestinian lands without official declaration. Observers say that Israel is moving ahead with settlement construction and is erecting new roads to only serve settlers, while at the same time, the occupying regime is squeezing Palestinians out of their land, their ancestors' land, to make their dream of an independent state impossible. Mona Kandil, in front of the illegal settlement of Pesigot, occupied Ramallah.
Coming out in the cold to make sure everyone gets to keep their home warm in winter, amid the soaring cost of living in Britain. The government here blames the skyrocketing cost of living on global energy price hikes. These protesters, however, say it's the big companies that have made windfall profits who should foot the bill, not them.
Shell made £14 billion of profit. £14 billion. And BP made £10 billion. Why not take some of that and use that to pay for it?
They need to subsidise those bills. Why not? They've already written off £9 billion on PPE. They've written off £4.9 billion on bad debt, bad COVID loans, bounce back loans. So subsidise us.
The country's energy regulator, Ofgem, has risen the price cap in place to protect the people by more than 50%. The government has introduced a loan scheme to help out, up to $270 per household. But experts say the underlying drivers remain.
There are already a lot of people struggling to keep their homes warm, particularly those who live in houses that are not properly insulated. And the recent price hikes are expected to push as many as a quarter of UK households into fuel poverty.
Rising bills will affect millions, but they'll bite the hardest for those with fewer choices. Add to that a tax rise set to kick in come April.
It doesn't have to be tax, tax, tax all the time. We need to have something to be given to us as well. It's like the benefits are not there anymore for us. So you go to work and you're still ending up being in a situation that, where should I go? I can't afford this, I can't afford that. And every year is situation just getting worse and worse.
Someone young and starting off, you know, ready to buy a house and earn a living, it does make me quite worried, especially living in London. Cost of living keeps on rising. Wage is not really reflected in that. So, I mean, I am quite worried about my future and the high cost of living.
Millions of British households will soon face energy bills of more than $2,000 a year. Whether that much can be managed depends on how much you earn and where you live. Saeed Purza, London.
The fuel shortage in Yemen is taking a heavy toll on the health sector. Officials in charge of medical oxygen plants say they are among the worst affected by the shortage. The problem is rooted in Saudi Arabia preventing the entry of ships carrying fuel. They are also blocking imports of medical equipment.
The halt in the work of oxygen plants means deaths of thousands of patients, including those who suffer from chronic diseases and need constant access to oxygen. Some plants have partially shut down, and the United Nations must do its duty and force Saudi Arabia to lift the siege imposed on Yemen. The Saudi-led coalition is clearly intent to kill Yemenis, whether by targeting homes with airstrikes or by cutting off medical supplies to them.
The Ministry of Health says only 13 oxygen plants are now working.
As a result of the blockade on Yemen and prevention of fuel ships entry, the output of oxygen plants has decreased by 45%, which may lead to a complete inability to provide oxygen to health facilities. The fuel crisis caused heavy losses to 13 oxygen plants that used to produce over 6,000 cylinders per day, and is fed to nearly 3,000 cylinders, and this threatens the lives of thousands of patients, including children.
Yemen has been suffering under the blockade by Saudi Arabia and its allies since they began their deadly aggression on the country in March 2015. Yemen's Ministry of Health says the siege has pushed at least 300 health facilities to the verge of collapse as their generators stop working due to the severe fuel shortage.
Yemeni health officials say only half of the country's health facilities are still functional, and over 80% of Yemenis face significant challenges in accessing basic care services. Many people here believe that the United Nations should be held responsible for remaining silent toward the illegal Saudi blockade imposed on Yemen. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Tens of thousands of people marched nationwide while an estimated 3,000 cars converged in Paris for a freedom convoy emulating the anti-government movement in Ottawa. The convoy was led by France's Yellow Vests, who resumed their Saturday marches in October and also included some of the long-running protesters against a vaccination smart pass so strict it's been called a de facto vaccine mandate. Equally important for protesters was expressing long-running disapproval of President Emmanuel Macron and his right-wing socioeconomic policies.
The price of gas is killing us. It's all become too much for us to accept. If we keep letting things go, where is France going to end up?
France responded by flooding Paris with over 7,000 police, who waged yet another violent crackdown on peaceful protests. Dozens were arrested, hundreds of fines were issued, tear gas was constant on the famed Champs-Élysées Avenue, and cars were impounded.
I came here from Bordeaux. The government responds with violence because they have nothing else to offer. And this is why the French do not understand them. I do not think the French are stupid. They want to understand. All we want is some answers to our many questions on policy.
In order to prevent the Freedom Convoy from implanting itself, the capital was locked down in many areas, something which Paris saw every Saturday for over 6 months in late 2018 and early 2019. Freedom Convoy may have already wrested a concession. The government announced plans to abolish the pass at the end of March. Many called the timing curious, as that would be just before voters first go to the polls on April 10th. Protesters say they expect more attempts at an Ottawa-style freedom convoy, no matter how repressed by the government this one has been. It's possible the French election campaign of 2022 has just begun. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Never has it been so costly for EU citizens to heat their homes, use electricity or drive their vehicles. 40% of the 27 nation bloc's energy supply requirements are imported from Russia. So is Moscow to blame for the EU's current energy crisis? Not according to European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, speaking in the European Parliament last October.
Gazprom has honoured its long-term contracts with us.
However, last Monday it was claimed Russia has cut gas to the EU, and citizens were told plans are in train to offset further suffering.
We're determined to prevent that from happening and to mitigate the impact on energy supplies and prices should Russia choose to cut natural gas supplies to Europe more than it already has.
The fact is, Russia has fulfilled all of its EU gas supply contracts. We've raised this issue with the European Commission.
Is the West using energy as a tool to ramp up tensions with Moscow?
Whether you draw conclusions with wider implications point to additional tensions of a military nature, this is your interpretation. This is not anything that we have said so far.
Political commentators claim the EU's negative Russia strategy is entirely being driven by the US.
They can't have an independent policy. It's a tragedy, I think, because Europeans should have a good relation with Russia. Russia is their neighbour. They share responsibility for the continent, for its future, for its security.
17 billion euro of EU taxpayers' money has been sent to Ukraine since 2014. This despite the European Court of Auditors declaring last September that corruption is rife in the country.
What has been done since September to try and ensure that the 17 billion euro won't be squandered?
If there are shortcomings found and proven, then we are working on removing them and making sure that what we do with Ukraine complies with our rules and with our guidelines.
On the issue of gas, of course, Russia could increase supplies to the EU, but what incentive does it have to do so in the current climate? Observers ask. Russia has the largest natural gas reserves in the world, followed by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Analysts say the EU's access to these markets is being hampered due to influence from the United States, and ultimately it is ordinary citizens who are paying the price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The images are difficult to look at, but the reality of life for so many people in Bahrain is still one of imprisonment and uncertainty. With a few days shy of the 11-year anniversary of the uprising in Manama and surrounding districts, activists in the UK are marking the occasion. One by one, the speakers took to the podium, erected on the pavement outside the Bahraini embassy in London, with a message of defiance and resistance.
We cannot continue to be controlled and ruled by hereditary dictatorships. That time has finished. It must cease to continue. It must come to an end. That is what our people in Bahrain want to achieve. And inshallah, they will achieve that.
In the decade plus since the revolution, Manama has even managed to export some of its violence.
They are participating and helping in bombing the Yemeni children, the Yemeni women. How can this be justified by the Bahraini regime? They are also, on the other hand, have sold the lands of the Arabs and Muslims in Palestine. They have kneeled to the wishes of the Zionists, the international Zionism.
Bahrain has featured on UK parliamentary agendas, has been the subject of official inquiries with the British government, but still no progress. This as activists seek a peaceful path to lasting reforms.
It's very unfortunate that what is called international community is headed by some who are the main reason for the problems in the world. The United States and Western Europe, who are backing the dictators rather than backing the people.
Activists argue the continuing atrocities committed against the Bahraini people can only happen with the consent of the international community, and are urging fresh action, not just words.
After over a decade of broken promises, false dawns, imprisonment, intimidation, torture, and even death, the brave freedom fighters for Bahrain have pledged to fight on to get Bahrain and its people the justice they are owed. Amina Taylor, London.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Russia says it's pulling back a number of its soldiers near the Ukraine border. Extensive military drills, however, continue, but some units are going back to their bases. Ukrainian Foreign Ministry says that they have managed with their partners to deter Russia from further escalation. This while the Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman says that the day will go into history as the day that Western war propaganda failed. Stay with us for a discussion of the issue. So let's first go to Brussels, to our correspondent Jerome Hughes, to hear the European side of the story. Jerome, over to you.
Behrouz, I think the latest developments here, tomorrow Wednesday, and also Thursday, NATO defense ministers are due to hold a meeting here at NATO headquarters in Brussels, and there is speculation that they will actually agree on basically expanding NATO infrastructure further east,
which has the potential, of course, to ramp up tensions even more and to provoke Moscow. Also tomorrow, European Parliament, there's due to be a lengthy debate in the European Parliament tomorrow, Wednesday, on this very subject, running for 3.5 hours. And it's anticipated, of course, there will be a lot of anti-Russia rhetoric, but also a lot of EU lawmakers who believe that really we have pushed Russia a bit too far and we're seeing the results. And even earlier today, there was a debate in the Parliament on EU defence. And the point was made that while the West is accusing Russia of, you know, being on the brink of breaching international law with a potential invasion into Ukraine, which Moscow denies that's the intention, there's hypocrisy there because we see time and time again breaches of international law. For example, the point was made in the Parliament today, the fact that so many arms are built here and sold that are used, for example, in Yemen. So there is a great deal of hypocrisy. Antony Blinken, you'll remember, the US Secretary of State last week, also talked about Russia cutting gas supplies to Europe. And, you know, the analysts I've been speaking to saying this is very unhelpful type of language, especially when it's completely untrue. Russia has fulfilled all its contracts. Gazprom has fulfilled all its contracts with Europe. And yet you have this type of language which creates a perception in the public mind that, you know, it demonizes Russia, which, again, isn't very helpful in terms of how Vladimir Putin and authorities in Russia could respond to the overall crisis. So again, the big developments here in the coming days, I think, will be the NATO defense ministers meeting and also the big debate that we're anticipating in the European Parliament.
Okay, thanks for that, Jerome. Here's our correspondent in Brussels. Now, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests joining us in this edition. We'll have radio host and journalist Don DeBar from Westport. Also with us will be journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich in Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome, Don. Good to have you with us. So the U.S. and NATO have been talking about the inevitability of Russian invasion. Is Russia going to invade Ukraine?
I mean, it's a complex question. First of all, the United States has maintained repeatedly that Russia was about to invade Ukraine since 1992. They have maintained repeatedly since the U.S.-backed coup in 2014 that Russia has invaded and is occupying parts of Ukraine. They refer sometimes to Crimea, sometimes to also Donbass region. They very have really never presented any evidence to support any of this to the public. We see the kind of evidence that they use in making the assessments that they make public on display at the State Department a week or so ago, where Matt Lee from the AP and a couple of other people in the pool there, by the way, who are generally fairly docile in the face of some of the most absurd things that come out of the State Department, really pressing on the point of evidence for the latest claim that there was, you know, going to be a false flag event and an invasion follow-on in Ukraine. So Russia is confronted with a massing along its borders from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula now of American military assets, including all kinds of anti-missile hardware, which could perhaps neutralize their strategic, mutually assured destruction defense, neutralize that entirely, leaving them open to a first strike by the United States. Men and materiel up at the borders, a militarized state in the bordering states in the Baltics, for example, and in Poland, the borders militarized in all of those places. In Estonia, they announced a week ago that provisions had been made for, you know, another expeditionary force of shock troops of 5,000 or something to, land and, be outfitted and ready for action. Ukraine is massing its own military, such as it is, and the Azov and the other stormtrooper battalions, basically, along the eastern border where the Russian Ukrainians live and their artillery in violation of the Minsk Agreement. Russia is looking at being invaded, and instead of it being from Germany as it was in 1941 with Operation Barbarossa, it's pretty much at the point, with the exception of Belarus, which they failed to take last December, almost at the fullest expression of Hitler's invasion. That's where they would be beginning. Mm-hmm. So for them to put their defenses up against that line, the U.S. is treating that as aggression. I don't know how they're going to counter it. If they start seeing movement in the backfield, they'd be insane to not, quote unquote, invade in order to break up the invasion force before it has a chance to sweep across the country. I'm scared, really. It looks very dangerous.
All right. Now, from Belgrade, let me bring in John Bosnett. John, good to have you with us. British Prime Minister Johnson said on Monday that this invasion of Ukraine could take place within 48 hours. So that means in a few hours. So what's the truth behind this imminence of invasion that the U.S. and the U.K. have been talking about recently?
Well, the United States is, in standard form, speaking out of both sides of its mouth. The United States maintains as its principal position that Russia has already invaded Ukraine and has already seized possession of the Crimea, even though that was done by referendum. The United States does not recognize that. Mm-hmm. And the United States says that the Russian ethnic resistance to take over from Kiev in eastern Ukraine is a Russian invasion. So I don't understand how they can say at one time that there might be a Russian invasion and at the same time simultaneously say that there already is a Russian invasion. That's point one. Point number two is that under no circumstances would anything even closely resembling this be allowed by America on its borders. America would have intervened directly, called it a police action, restoring the peace and restoring stability in a neighboring country. They cannot have it both ways.
Right. Now, Don, Ukraine's defense minister said on Tuesday that he received no information so far indicating the possibility of a Russian invasion of his country shortly. And that's an indication that invasion of Ukraine, maybe it's not a reality. It's only a hype. If you remember, what happened regarding the wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq, that were based on lies of the U.S. and Britain. So how do you see the role that the media in the West has played to regarding the crisis over Ukraine?
First,
how
you reach such a point of unanimity across the media in the U.S., and I would say throughout much of Europe, too, with some important contradictions, on something that is so obviously at least contentious, if not complete fabrication. From Fox to CNN to MSNBC, to Pacifica Radio and Democracy Now! And The Guardian and whatever, so-called progressive outlets. There's a segmented marketing approach to why we are in this problem, but there is a unity of agreement across the board that Russia is some evil threat that has to be dealt with. Fox points to Biden and says Biden is too weak to deal with dangerous Russia. MSNBC was pointing to Trump, saying that Trump is too soft on Russia because he's a Russian puppet, and everything in between. Someone somewhere that makes the decisions about how to broadcast these segmented messages to the American public and the world through the U.S. media outlets, which are the largest in the world, they have decided to organize the military and political structures of the U.S., Europe, and its allies in Asia into a war mode directed at Russia. And there is some indication, including it was a recently re-released RAND study, that you know the intent is to force regime change in Russia that they believe they can do by cranking up this pressure. On the other side of the coin, you know, President Putin and the Russian Duma, by the way, with their own message, which almost unanimously yesterday or today called on President Putin to recognize the Donbass breakaway republics. He has said, look, you guys, this is existential for us. We know what happens next. We're not going to have another replay of World War II. We will fight where we decide to fight if you force a fight. And so, you know, we're looking at a situation analogous to 1962. We even had a little submarine incident over the weekend that could have escalated into nuclear war. The United States probing Russian waters with nuclear submarines. But we don't have John Kennedy sitting in the White House now. Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, John, now let's hear your thoughts regarding the role of the Western media in this.
Well, being a journalist myself by profession, I can tell you that what was once a lively media has greatly, greatly descended in quality. I can tell you that there's a kind of a groupthink in the media that's imposed from the top down from the owners of the media. Mm-hmm. And if you don't conform with the groupthink, you lose your job. And that I've seen across media in Europe, in North America, and in Asia. So I can tell you that the military-industrial complex has seized upon the fact that their first weapon in the war is always the media. If they can convince the public that the designated enemy is evil, and then they demonize that enemy as they have been doing with Russia for decades, then they believe that they can get away with quick, short wars. Obviously, this would never be a quick, short war. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that the objective of the NATO side is to develop hysteria, allow the hysteria to give a free hand to the Western governments to provoke a Russian response by putting aggressive attack weaponry on the very border of Russia. And if Russia responds in any way to those provocations, then blame the entire situation on Russia. Mm-hmm. And this cannot wash with any educated person, because we all know that the coup d'etat that overthrew the elected president of Ukraine was run directly out of the U.S. government.
Right. Now, Don, Russia has certain demands, as you know. It wants NATO to pull back troops and weapons from Eastern Europe. It wants Ukraine not to join the military alliance. Tell us why Russia is concerned about NATO's eastward expansion.
For the same reason that the U.S. almost went to nuclear war, because the Soviet Union put a couple of dozen nuclear missiles in Cuba, 90 miles away from the U.S. border. Mm. You know, it changes the strategic balance to a position where the defending nation state has a very limited response time to determine whether or not something is an actual immediate threat or a potential threat. When you have nuclear weapons and you're on a 5 or 3 or 12 minute response time, you have an envelope of that much time to respond, and you can't tell whether or not something coming at you is a nuclear weapon or a flock of birds or whatever. Hmm. You have your finger on the button in defense. You know, it's a dangerous condition. And this is a condition that does not have to exist. The United States has voluntarily organized the former buffer states. That's what the Warsaw Pact was. Buffer states that were negotiated after World War II, after Germany had for the second time in a century invaded Russia, mm-hmm. and they had swallowed them all up and put in material that now, rather than meaning we're only a week's march from Moscow, puts nuclear missiles 3-4 minutes from Moscow. So mm-hmm. that whenever someone in Washington calls Putin up and says, look, we want you to sign over Rosneft. We want Gazprom to be owned by Standard Oil or whatever. We've got our finger on the button. If somebody hiccups, they don't know if this is 30 thermonuclear warheads coming into Moscow or a bird, you know, a flock of birds. It's not a place to be able to conduct normal relations from. And it's exactly the condition that's been imposed on Russia. And Russia has the wherewithal to push back, and they have indicated that they're going to do it. And if you look at it objectively, they have given as much space as they could. Rather than pushing back when they first moved material into East Germany against the promise that was given back by the Reagan administration, George Shultz, all of that, to a number of Russian officials, they have waited until they're knocking on the door with the most advanced weaponry ever and the largest amount of it that they've faced since Hitler came in.
Okay. Now, John, talking about Moscow's demands, the U.S. and NATO allies have not given a proper response. They've kind of rejected those demands. So does this not mean that this crisis will continue to simmer as long as those demands are not taken heed of?
Well, I think that we're in a situation where if talking doesn't work, psychological pressure might. I want to just retouch two points here about the so-called Cuban missile crisis. Well, actually, the Soviet deployment in Cuba was a response to a prior NATO deployment of missiles in Turkey, which very few people still today know were secretly withdrawn in return for the withdrawal of the Russian missiles, of the Soviet missiles from Cuba. So the provocation, even back then in 1962, was on the side of NATO and on the West. Mm-hmm. And if we want to put the shoe on the other foot, we should remember that in World War I, when the German government merely sent a telegram, just sent a telegram to Mexico offering the return of territories that America had taken from Mexico, the American government rolled into action to declare war on Germany.
Right.
If Russia were to respond today to what America has done in Ukraine, staging a coup, sending in advisors, and shipping over weapons, we would already long ago have been at war with Russia directly attacking America. The Americans do not follow their own principles and their own words. They're double-crossing not just Russia, but the entire world.
Mm-hmm. Now, Don, the U.S. Has supplied arms, including Javelin anti-tank missiles, to Ukraine. Germany has refused to provide any weapons, and Kiev is not happy about it. So how do you see Europe's position, especially Germany and France, in this crisis?
Now, people tend to forget even what's happened recently, let alone over the last 50 years or so. Maybe back 54 years, there was a real possibility that Germany, even France, were going to have revolutions and the people were going to join the Soviet bloc or make some third way or whatever out of it. Mm. The popular opinion inside Germany, for example, was highly negative when the Reagan administration introduced cruise missiles into Germany. People there have, and particularly 30, 40 years ago, but even now, a memory of the continent, their countries being devastated by war twice in the 20th century. And the staging of these weapons in their country, they're smart enough, regardless of what even their media says, to understand that those weapons become targets of the Russians in self-defense in the event of a war. And so there is strong opposition to the possibility even of Germany or France or Italy, these countries among the population being the battlefield for a war between the United States and Russia. And so at the bottom of it, you have this percolating. In addition to that, in the United States itself, since the 2020 election, there was an article in Press TV, actually at PressTV.ir, about the January 6th joint session where the ratification of the election took place. Half the population here that watched that stuff unfold understands that the election, or certainly believes, that the election was stolen. And they don't even see this president as being legitimate. 4 years prior to that, the other half of the population didn't think that President Trump was legitimate. Now, generally, when you go to war, you go in with united public opinion. That was organized for both the Iraq wars and every other adventure the U.S. has gone on in the last 50 years. That is an impossible precondition to establish now. And going against Russia is going to be an entirely different kettle of fish, as they say, then going against Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, etc.
Okay. John, regarding what concerns Russia, I fear we have a flashback at history. Let's remember what the U.S. did to Yugoslavia and what the Europeans did. So is this not, again, maybe another reason why Russia is concerned about NATO's expansion?
Absolutely. As a reporter who was here during the bombing and had 16 of my colleagues killed by American bombing of a television station just like your own, I can tell you that the rules of war for America have no meaning. And that means that the entire concept of an international court of justice, which they do not recognize, the superpower that doesn't recognize the International Court of Justice, means that we are on a knife edge here where no moral code, no written law, or even signed treaty has any validity in the eyes of the American military-industrial complex, which just operates the sitting president as a puppet through the Congress. So I think we are in a very dangerous situation. I think that we are all very, very lucky that a statesman like President Putin is controlling the events here and letting the aggressive NATO side have a good taste of what it feels like to have a Damoclean sword hanging over your head. And that's what the West has been doing to Russia since the end of the Soviet Union. And I think that Russia has to call it end of the game for NATO, and it has drawn the line at the absolute last possible moment. And in that sense, Russia cannot back up on this, and the West must yield. That's the way things stand.
Okay. On that note, we've come to the end of this show. Let me thank our guests. We had radio host and journalist Don DeBar in Westford and journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich in Belgrade. And I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. capitalism cannot be allowed to drive the bus when it comes to dealing with this or any pandemic, says William Rivers Pitt journalist in an article published under the heading, Having learned nothing from 900,000 deaths, U.S. governors lift mask mandates. Stay tuned for more. In March 2020, then-President Trump declared a national state of emergency over the pandemic, and an avalanche of states went under some version of a lockdown. Almost immediately, Trump began hectoring his own scientific experts to downplay the dangers of COVID-19 as he pushed to reopen the economy as soon as possible. It was a hard sell, even as the jobless numbers swelled into the millions of businesses began closing all over. A clear majority of the country believed in science of masking, cloistering and social distancing. Some 25,000 people had died from COVID by then, a number that, in our innocence, many of Americans found almost too appalling to contemplate. That quacking reached the crescendo the following spring, and various state and local governments in the United States chose to let their collective guard down in the name of making money for U.S. financial overlords. The result? A massive surge of COVID obliterated hopes and drove people back indoors again. The winter of 2020 to 2021 was upon Americans, and the Red Death held sway over all. The following spring brought widely available vaccines, actual vaccines that actually work. Millions lined up to get their shots, although millions also flatly refused to give the vaccines a second thought because doing so became tied to fealty to Trump and his doomed attempt to overthrow the election he had lost in November. The efficacy of the vaccines was blunted, and when Biden promised new hope that summer, he and the rest of Americans were confronted with 1-2 punch of Delta and Omicron variants. Down into the darkness, Americans went again, with a death toll totaling over 900,000 souls at a clip of about 2,500 per day. Over all those days, weeks, months, and now years, activists sounded warning after warning after warning. Capitalism cannot be allowed to drive the bus when it comes to dealing with this or any pandemic. The very corporations clamoring to rush people back into infected workspaces are the ones funding Republicans who rally their people to resist the vaccines. They have no interest in public health. Their goal is private wealth, and as far as they are concerned, wealth must be extracted at all costs. Disabled and immunocompromised people will be hit hardest by this new dismissal of effective public safety measures. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have made it clear that it is far too soon after Delta and Omicron to begin dickering around with masking, one of the most effective basic prophylactics against random infection. As for the Biden administration, well, this charge toward false normalcy came after the president pointedly said last week that decisions like these would be made by the states and not the federal government, and it's an election year. The moves highlight how even local officials who installed sweeping safety measures early in the pandemic are now preparing to live permanently with the virus, reports the New York Times. Watch for that phrasing, live permanently with the virus, as it will be everyone soon. Sounds all stiff upper lip, right? Loosely translated, it means this is the course that promises the most profit and must be adhered to without question. In other words, the capitalists are sick of you. It's time to give up. They're mightily weary of fighting for ground they thought was secure. Yes, you may die horribly at the hands of such twisted, profit-driven priorities. So long as you die coughing with a dollar in your hand while reaching for something to buy, you will have done a proper turn of service to your society as the third COVID winter plays incubator for the future.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.